So here we are, popular Hinduism. And we're going to look at ritual and temples. So Hinduism is a religion of ritual par excellence, really. And it's what's ritual? Ritual is arguably a symbolic activity that conveys information or says something about human situations, about social relationships, and about relationships with some other world. And puja, which means is ritual really, is ritual focused on the family god in the house, or the temple deity, or on some other shrine, such as a sacred tree in a village. So puja is basically making an offering to a deity and receiving a blessing. It's as simple as that, and it can be elaborated into several days or just a moment. And rituals can be daily or occasional or for a special occasion, such as the samskaras. The samskaras are the rites of passage. So at birth, first outing, first food, tonsure, shaving the baby's head, naming ceremony, the sacred thread ceremony, the marriage ceremony, and funeral. They're all samskaras.
That's samskara meaning a ritual.
Yeah. It also has, it also means the karmic traces in like Buddhism, esoteric Buddhism. So in puja, the ritual implements are purified with mantras. And ritual implements are things like a bell, a conch, and a five-flamed arati lamp that you wave around the deity and bring to people as the light of the god. Food, flowers, and incense, all offerings, all purified with mantra. And there are three features of ritual. There's purity. Rituals occur in clean surroundings, especially the kitchen. The kitchen's a pure places in Hindu homes. Worshippers must bathe and must be in a pure state, so that includes clothing, so you've got to wear cotton, silk, not menstruating, not mourning, etc. And purity means the absence of pollution, such as the bodily effluence, decaying objects, anything to do with death are all polluting. So when last week we saw the Karpalikas covering themselves in the cremation ground ashes, that's very polluting. So a high caste Brahmin would be very concerned with ritual purity and keeping himself ritually pure. Pranam, which is saluting the feet of the gods, is the basic ritual gesture by bowing with hands clasped. We have Anjali, we heard that, didn't we, in one of our Sanskrit classes, Anjali. Saluting the feet, with hands clasped, and not touching the ground or the feet of the deity, and then one's own forehead. So you touch the feet, and you get this with holy men and women. People will touch their feet and then touch their heads to say that, my head is lower than your feet, so you're higher than me. And this symbolically demonstrates the lower status of the worshippers of the god of the holy man. Pranam.
That's when they're totally prostrated, is it?
Well, yes, you do get that total prostration. But you can just sort of touch the person's feet and touch your head.
Because when I see Sri Mata, that's what people were doing. They were
full pranam.
Full pranam. Shashtang pranam, which means. Shasht is how many?
Six.
So six points of which touch the ground.
How
do you spell that?
Shashtang. Shashtang pranam. Shashtang pranam.
Yeah.
Which are the head?
The head.
The hands, the feet.
The head, the
shoulders.
Shoulders.
Must be the feet, wasn't it? The
feet, yeah.
The 6 points, must be the head.
6 points, what?
One, two, three, four, five.
This middle part is kept up.
Yeah.
So, one, two, three, four, five, six.
That must be the
first of feet.
Actually, the feet. Like this, I have to show you.
That's enough. Can I see?
It's 1 foot is kept up on the other one.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
Like
sorry,
this.
That.
So 6 points.
6 points.
The 6 points being your one for your feet, one for your head.
Yeah.
1 foot touches the other one.
Yes. Sure. That's one for your feet. Is it one for your head? And what are the other four? Shoulders.
Yeah. Hands and shoulders.
Shoulders, hands and shoulders. Thank you.
Ramesh, do you know the meaning of the 1 foot going on the other foot?
Right, this is because it's six points. So I don't know exactly what it means to put the other foot, but that is one.
How interesting, wrong.
Some restraint of some order.
One head. Two wrists, is it, or two hands?
Well, you've done it. You should have done that.
Two shoulders.
So that's pranayama. And then the prasad is food offered to the deity and then eaten by the community of worshippers. Prasad. So prasadam meant grace in theology. So the Upanishads, the idea of prasada comes in with the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. And food is offered to the deity and then eaten by the community of worshippers. Somebody's correcting me, I said deity, but it's deity apparently.
Is it?
So it's a bit like Holy Communion, isn't it?
Just like that. Yeah, sharing the food, that's right. Blessed food.
Breaking the bread.
So this is prasad, from prasada meaning grace. And high orthodox deities are vegetarian, such as Krishna, Vishnu, Shiva indeed. And low or unorthodox deities are not. So the low retinues of yoginism, goddessism that protect the villages, they usually demand blood and alcohol. And they don't accept vegetarian offerings.
So it's Krishna, Vishnu, Shiva.
Yeah, they're high gods who only accept vegetarian offerings. They would be polluted if you offer them meat, or blood, or alcohol. Or they'd be insulted. They wouldn't be polluted because they're pure.
Apparently you don't offer any wheat products either.
No wheat, that's right.
I don't know why.
I don't know why wheat either. No. Rice, you could offer rice. And you could offer fruits. It must be to do with the goodness. It must be to do with the classification of food.
Maybe so. There may be also. There's. I don't know. I don't understand. Very interesting. Actually, to go in the symbolic and emblematic meanings, which is what I've been doing in the Hebrew Bible, etc. Again and again and again. And there is high significance. So there may be real significance in that, which I don't fully understand at the moment.
Fruit and nuts are what they are. But wheat products have been modulated.
It could be also possibly that it's regarded as tamasic or heavy or something rather than light food. I'm not sure.
Because it would contain butter or other products.
Yeah. So anyway, they only accept some kinds of pure food offerings. And certain kinds of food offering convey superior status to whom it is offered. So the eating leftovers, the gutta, is very polluting. So in eating the leftovers of the deity, the worshipper is putting himself or herself in a very low position with regard to the deity. So you offer the food and you take it away and eat it, and you're eating what the god has left over. So you're eating the god's leftovers.
Sorry, can when they offer the food to the god, but then you said there's communal eating.
Yeah,
is that a separate lot of food, or is it the same?
Same food, yeah.
They've offered the whole lot, but if you eat the leftovers, I misunderstand.
Yeah, sometimes what happens is that you prepare a dish of all the things which are cooked.
Yes.
And then offer it at the altar. And then take all that stuff and put it back into the original pots.
Yes.
Then everything becomes consecrated.
Yeah.
So then the community can eat the whole thing.
And then what is it that is polluting then? Is there anything that's left in the... If they ate what was left in the original...
No, no. It's always left pure. It's purified. Yeah, it's purified.
That makes sense. That makes absolute sense. That makes sense. Sorry. Thank you.
But in a sense, you're through eating the... this is anthropologist's interpretation. Through eating the food that you've offered, you're eating what the god has left.
Yes.
So it's like you're symbolically putting yourself lower than the god.
But it's again. Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Sanctified food.
Sanctified food.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And temple worship, so that structure occurs in the temple and the home. Now, a zone of purity, if you like, surrounds the image of the deity, the murti, or the archa, or whatever, vigraha, whatever word is used. In the temple, the mandir. And the degree of purity required by the gods varies depending upon their status. So the gods in the temple require a very high degree of purity. Household shrines, less purity. So the outcasts, technically those who are outside the caste system, cannot enter many Hindu temples because they are polluting. Although that's technically illegal, there are no such things. There's a scheduled classes, but there's no untouchability anymore, technically in India. And there was a law passed not too long ago, I think, that it's saying that anyone can enter temples. But practically, it doesn't happen. I mean, I think Kerala, you don't get no cars going into the temples. They're not allowed in, really. Although technically, they're allowed in. They're not allowed in temples.
What is purity in Sanskrit?
Shaucha or Shuchi. Shuddhi.
Oh, yeah.
So the image of the deity must be bathed, washed, fed, and kept pure. I think it's less strict in the north, but certainly in the south, some of those southern temples are very strict. And you can't go unless you're a Hindu.
Is Shuddhi connected with Sutta, which is elixir, isn't it?
No, it's not connected with elixir. It's su, that's to sip or to drink, su. Sup, I guess, is related to that. So sutta, I think it's an alcoholic drink, sutta.
I thought sutta or sutan is to do with elixir, nectar, no?
You might be right, I'll have to look that up. Sutta. I thought sutta was
sun.
Hmm?
Isn't sutta sun? Sun of.
Oh, sutra, there's a word.
Sutta is elixir, sutan is nectar.
Ah. Sutta. I thought sutta was an alcoholic drink.
Maybe it's that as well.
It's like soma, isn't it? Soma.
Soma.
Soma. I mean, there's a lot of symbolical meaning in that. Huge.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So you've got to bathe the deity, wash the deity, feed the deity, keep the deity pure, wake the deity up, put the deity to bed, and so on. So it's treated like a person, like a king. And temples may serve a particular caste or a general region. So in regional temples, untouchables may enter the outer compound, but not the temple building itself. And there they may receive prasad brought up from the temple, or they may worship a lower manifestation of the deity. So Jagannath temple in Puri, low castes, and even the Hare Krishna devotees are not allowed into the main shrine. And you have to worship a deity outside of the main shrine, outside the temple. I can't remember who the deity is now. Sure, I can't remember. Let's do that. But in the south, it's more strict, particularly strict in the south. Sometimes you get into temples in the south. And you can only wear certain kinds of clothes. You've got to wear a dhoti. But they just give you a dhoti to put around you. So, ritual, the deities, are very closely related to social structure and different groups. Different kinds of deities worshipped by different groups of people. This is more or less based on Babb's book, The Divine Hierarchy. So ritual is linked to caste. So you've got a place of worship. You've got three levels here that he identifies, which I think is fairly accurate. And you've got a regional temple, which developed in the medieval period, which were also political centres, as well as centres of learning. And the gods, they're usually high gods, they're textual-orientated, they've got Puranas written about them, and there's ritual padatis, ritual texts related to them, and they're vegetarians, Vishnu, Krishna, Shri, Ayyappan, all these other high Hindu gods. And the priests there are the Brahmins and the pure Pujaris. Perhaps there aren't necessarily Brahmins, but they're Pujaris, who are people who do puja, but who are high caste and pure. And then you get a lower level of worship, structurally lower, I mean, in the villages and caste shrines. There's a word missed out on that one, the village level. And where you get lower local deities, and you get priests such as, they're called bikers in North India, who do pujas to these local deities, who are specific to that village, usually, or that region. And then you get local village shrines, which are often to goddesses, who are often in an iconic form, just represented by a stone, or a stone with two eyes painted on it. And these are worshipped by the low castes, and they're regarded by the high castes as impure. And they have local priests. And these often demand blood sacrifice and alcohol to appease them.
What sort of blood sacrifice? Is that sheep and goats and things? Or
usually chickens in the chickens, south. But yeah, it can be sheep and goats rather. And sometimes buffalo. Buffalo sacrifice still practiced in to Durga in South India, Tamil Nadu. But that's polluting to the high castes.
And what's happening at the bottom? Priest and untouchable?
That should be just higher up. That's untouchable caste, low castes, untouchable castes, who are regarded as impure. And the priests, they're local priests, low caste priests. And we'll see illustrations of this in a second. So that's the kind of structure to bear in mind. So these big regional temples, from the 11th to 13th century, these large temple complexes were built at centres of the regional kingdoms, such as Jagannath at Puri, Chidambaram, big temples, Shiva temple, Chidambaram, the temples in Tanjavur and Tamil Nadu. These wonderful temples, wonderful places, if you ever get a chance to visit them. I've shown you some of these before, but I thought I'd just whiz through them again. You get these really, Mahabalipuram was the earliest, carved out of the rock, you know, on the beach there, Shiva temple. That's about 7th, 8th century. And you get the Padmanabha Swami temple at Tiruvananthapuram, which is in Kerala. What's the English name?
Trivandrum.
Trivandrum. There's a rather wonderful temple there, the Vishnu temple. The Swami, the Lord, whose navel is a lotus. The group around the gates of these temples. So you get the temple in the middle, and you get surrounded by a wall or several walls, and you get these gates like this, the group rooms. And Tanjavur, another wonderful 11th century, 10th, 11th century, Raja the First, do this, the Brihadeshwara, the great Lord temple. with Shiva Linga in the middle. And this is 11th century Shiva Linga, massive thing, and still worshipped by the Brahmins. There you see the size of the Brahmin compared to the Shiva Linga.
Is this one of the 12 Shiva Jyotirlingam sites in India?
I don't think it is. It may be. I don't know. And then you get these spontaneous lingas too.
That grow out of the ground.
Grow out of the ground. Like the cave in Kashmir.
And in Jageshwar in northern India. We've been there actually last November.
Oh, really?
And the 125 Shiva Lingams, each one has their own temple.
Oh, yes.
And one has grown out of the ground. It's sort of a rock that high, and there they've made the biggest temple around.
The spontaneous appearing lingas, This is a constructed one, I'm not sure what it's made of, but there was one like this made of gold that Somnath, which Mahmud of Ghazni came and took it away. We don't know what happened to it. He probably melted it down.
Tons of gold.
Tons and tons.
I mean, imagine a gold linga like that. Pure gold. Amazing. That was at Somnath, the Pashupatazan that. Another Tanjore temple, the Raja Rajeshwara temple. These are terribly old, only 11th century temples.
AD.
Yeah. As symbols of the gods. A bit parallel to the Gothic cathedrals, really.
Yes. Fantastic.
And this is at Gangaikonda Cholapuram, which is a Tamil, but the Puram is the city where the falling of the Ganges. So the Raja the second built this, and he went up to the Ganges and got some water from the Ganges and to consecrate this temple, which is now just a temple. It's a small village. It was originally a thriving town, but now it's just sort of like a wilderness outside of it, or a forest really. Trees, palm trees like this, but it's deserted apart from the temple. You do get some people doing pujas or vratams. When I was there was a family where the woman had shaved her head and was doing there was a shrine outside Durga on the other side actually, and she was doing a worship. She had done a vratam, a vow, an observance, because the goddess had done her a favour. I don't know what it was. So she shaved her head and she was doing these pranams to the goddess. And there's the side, and you've got these temple guardians you can see down at the bottom there. And these are the two temple guardians, Ananta and Nandin. Nandin becomes in later shows in the gentle bull that Shiva rides on, but originally he's a ferocious guardian of the doorway, Nandin. And Ananta is the other one, guarding the doors. And this is Chidambaram. Chidambaram is interesting because you've got these big gopurams. You've got the main temple there, which is smaller than the gopurams, and you've got this big tank, bathing, purification tank, the bathing.
So what's gopuram?
A gopuram is the gateway. So you've got four gateways, 1, 2, 3, 4, in the temple. And Chidambaram this is the heart of the city, and all the streets radiate out from the temple. So it was a big centre of learning in the 11th century. There's a Shiva Nataraja image, the dancing Shiva in the main shrine there. But a magnificent place really. And here's one of the gopurams at Chidambaram. These are slightly later, I think these are about 13th, 14th century. And another one of these wonderful Shaiva temples in the south for the Chola period, the Dharasuram, the Ayravatarishvara temple. The Alabhatra is the elephant of Indra, Indra's elephant, the temple of Indra's elephant.
Who is actually owning the temples? Is it the...
I think the government owns the temples.
The government owns all the temples?
Yeah, yeah. Huh. I think so, in the south. All the
region. It's not like in, put it in Japan, you know, that takeovers of temples and buy some and put them somewhere else.
Oh, no, you don't get that. No. Wow. No, I've never heard of that. They're a bit like National Trust, I suppose, something like that. Yeah. I mean, some of these are not really functioning temples anymore. Well, the ones at Tangipahoa are, but like this one is just a
museum.
Museum, really. Mm-hmm. Well, you get Brahmins still hanging out there. There's a this place. There's an old guy who's really completely bent over, but he'll tell you the history of the place from a few hundred rupees. They're quite expensive. And the Astaghal, there we are. It's a wonderful place to rest. Good car. And then at the opposite end, you've got these high caste temples like that, and then you've got these local shrines. And an example of these Tengam deities in Kerala. In Kerala, you have once a year, you have a festival season from about October through to the new year. And Tayam is a Malayalam version of the word Devan, probably God. And these are low caste traditions of ritual possession, where the god or goddess possesses a dancer, who then gives his darshan, his vision to the community. And all these groups in Kerala you've got two caste groups called Varna, those who are within the Varna system, and the Avarna, those who are outside. And the Varnas are the Nambudri Brahmins. So you've got two extremes in Kerala. You've got very high caste Nambudri Brahmins, very pure Brahmins, and then those who are outside the Avarnas. I've always got the Nayars. The Nayars are a warrior caste. And then you get the low caste, such as the Nayans. And the Tayans are restricted to the low castes. And these are ritual or dance possession rites that occur once a year. And I put poor of self there. You get this idea of Charles Taylor said that... made a contrast between what he called the porous self, where the edges, the boundaries of the self are porous and let in forces from the outside, whereas the buffered self of the modern self is buffered, i.e. protected, and we tend not to get possessed and so on these days because we're buffered. But the porous self of pre-modern world is not, like South India. So here's this is Vishnumurti. The dancers get dressed up like this, and it's a very great honour to be chosen to be a dancer. And these very elaborate costumes, and they're usually representing ferocious gods and goddesses. So you've got this one's got fangs, and he gets dressed up in like this. It's always a male, and he sings these songs in Malayalam to the god in the shrine. I probably told you this. She is beautiful, wonderful, all powerful. And then in the second person, you, direct address, the same song in the second person, and then the same song again in the first person. He looks into a mirror and says, "I am wonderful, powerful, magnificent," and so on. And the possession is complete. And then he'll dance around the compound, giving his vision to the people, to the community, and march out of the compound to the local local temple. Here's the different Chuliar Bhagavati goddess, and here he's asking to be let into the Shiva temple, and the Shiva temple won't open its doors, so he goes back giving his darshan through the streets to the compound again. So the high caste temple will not let in the low caste goddess. It excludes the low caste goddess.
It must be hugely transformational for the dancer. to become possessed and lose.
Yeah.
And sort of loss of your everyday identity.
That's right, the loss of your indexical, that's right. In a technical jargon, your indexical eye gets overwhelmed by the eye of the text or the eye of discourse.
This is the intextualization that
you were, in your
tantric body.
Yeah, that's right. It's the same idea.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
So your eye gets overwhelmed by some other eye. It's like a bit like, I mean, when you in a play, you say, you know, Shakespeare or something. In a sense, that's kind of happening there. But this is a more extreme version of that.
Is that what's called Devi Bhava?
I haven't heard that term, but
because you know Amaji, this hugging saint from Kerala, she gets possessed one of her underlings by the Devi, by the goddess. She dresses up and shows herself to everybody.
It's the
last day of her when she comes and tours the world.
Well, she's from Kerala, of course. Yeah. She's from a village in Kerala, so she's from that culture, that world.
Teyam is a female goddess.
Usually, not always. So Vishnumurti is a male, but these Bhagavatis are female. And they're not represented other than in these shrines all the year round, and then once a year they take on human form in these dances. And they go back to the shrine, and having danced around, and this is Chuliyar Bhagavati, the myth behind her, the Sultan of songs, are that she was a Brahmin put her in a pot and buried her in the ground, and she got so angry that she burst out of the pot and chased the Brahmin up the hill to the temple of Shiva, and there she would only be calmed down if she was installed next to Shiva, which happened. And there's Chuliyar Bhagavati represented there. And when she gets back to the shrine, having gone out to the Shiva temple, she's offered alcohol, palm wine, which is this pot of toddy, palm wine, and blood. And they have this pot of water, and then they chop a chicken's head off and put the chicken's body in the water so the blood goes into the water, and they chuck the chicken away, and then they offer the blood water, the grushi or the raktatoya, to the goddess and pour it out on the ground in front of her. And most of the year she lives in a shrine like this, just in these tridents or pots or shields or swords represented inside the shrine. And then once a year she comes out and gets put into these goddesses.
Sorry, what's palm wine in Sanskrit?
It's Malayalam, so it's
Malayalam. Sorry, I didn't mean it that way. It's just I thought you mentioned it. I thought you mentioned it.
I can't remember the word that we use, so I'll have to check that out.
Sorry, I thought you mentioned it, that's fine.
You mentioned toddy, I think.
What's toddy? What's toddy?
It's the traditional brew, I think.
Yeah. A traditional brew, okay.
Palm wine.
It's palm wine, is it? Sort of palm.
Toddy's an English word, isn't it? Toddy.
Is it?
I think so.
It became an English word as a result, through Anglo-Indian, presumably.
It could be.
Toddy. It's probably toddy. That's what you mentioned. I thought you mentioned something.
Yeah. So here she is again. This is a different one. I can't remember which one this is. Chuliyar Bhagavati, possibly. And put the chicken's body in the pot, which they will then pour out in front of her as an offering. And these dancers, they get. Some of them say they're possessed by the goddess, some of them say they just acted out, some of them say I don't remember what happens. It's a very high honour to be chosen. But their inner state is not important to the community. What's important to the community is that she does the right thing, is ritually enacted. And then people will go up to her and ask for predictions, ask, you know, will my son get into university or whatever they do.
Are those rituals codified in each temple? Are they written up or are they just orally?
They're just oral, yeah. They're not written up. It's pure oral tradition. And this is the Malayan. There are two castes here, the Malayan caste and another caste whose name I forget now, but it's a lower caste. So it's a higher caste, and the dancers are lower caste. They're all low caste, they're all outcasts, but the Malayan caste is lower than the people who they're performing for. And people will offer, make various offerings. So in this hut here, there's a scales just behind there where you can make an offering to the shrine of your weight, not your weight in gold, but your weight in bananas and coconuts, things like that. So you sit on the shrine and then somebody will fill it up with coconuts that you've paid for until it's balanced and you get merit for that, of course. Or somebody will offer these big umbrellas. So it's a very kind of prestigious occasion for everyone involved. And then you can see different. I mean, like this woman is a widow, because widows don't wear a top, and they dress in white. So you can tell widows. They're kind of akin to ascetics in a way. But often the tail is quite violent, and so she'll dance around the compound and hit. It's quite a big event. And all these young men follow her and chase after her and shout, and then she turns around and chases them, and they all run off. But one of them was so ferocious, she broke the sacred bow on someone's back. And one poor dancer, he had been chosen one year. It's a very, very high status thing to be chosen to dance. And he got into such a state that he danced through a fire. And he burnt his feet up and he couldn't dance after that.
Oh, that's
rather sad, really, that was. And then you get, in the same kind of world, but in a different caste, you get the Bhutri Brahmins, the high caste, who do domestic rituals. Now, this isn't temple rituals, this isn't big temple, this is domestic, local temple, local shrines in the back garden. Now, this particular family of Nambudris, Nambudris have what's called an ilam, which is a family homestead or home, and they all go back there once a year to kind of gather and have a celebration. And this particular family couldn't get their daughter, have I told you this story? Couldn't get their daughter married. And they asked the uncle, that's the uncle there, who's an astrologer. And he said, oh, it's because there's a goddess called Rakteshwari living in the tree, in the garden, and she's being ignored. So they built this little shrine in the garden and installed Rakteshwari from the tree into this image. You can just about see the image there with a mirror there with all these candles. Mm-hmm. And once a year they build this mandalam, this grass structure, and take the goddess from the image into the mandalam, where they offer her blood water. They can't, because they're Brahmins, they can't offer her blood, so they must offer her substitute blood. So they offer her substitute blood. Whereas in the low caste, they offer the goddess real blood. Here, the Nambudris offer the goddess substitute blood. And Akteshwari means the goddess of blood.
Did she find a husband?
No, she did actually. Yeah, they got her married. And this is towards the end of the ritual, where the light of the flame, the darshan of the arti lamp is brought round, and you pour the light of the god over your face, over your head. And he's just bringing it to his daughter now. And this is Ishvara, and he's bringing it to us who are standing up. We're not allowed into this compound because we're polluted, so we have to stand outside. And that's the family. And then afterwards they have a payasam, which is a sweet dessert. And they have a bit of a party after this.
Is this usually done annually?
Mm-hmm.
These temple festivals, are they done annually?
Yes.
Once a year,
but this is just this local, this is just this family, this extended family perform this in their garden. And Ishvara, he was an interesting character. He worked for the railways, but Kerala was distinct for its marriage arrangements. So the high caste Nambutris, the second sons, not the first born sons, the second sons would take wives from the Nayar caste, which is the lower caste. And the Nayar women would then live in their own huts, so their own houses, and bring up the children as Nayars. But the Brahmin husband wouldn't live with them, and would actually bring his own food because he would be polluted by her cooking.
So why do they do this inter-caste mixing?
Why do they do that? I don't know why that occurred. The British made it illegal, made those marriages illegal, banned those marriages, and so they haven't happened. But here, 100 years later, we got Ishvaran, who had a Nayar girlfriend and a kid. And another little girl running around who was a Nayar. It was just like this one. He was married, of course, to a Brahmin lady. But he had this very traditional kind of 100-year-old marriage situation, which was banned by the British. So he was an interesting character. And you can see his twice-born thread over his shoulder there. Oh, there we are. That's that one. That's it. So that's the Rakteshwari Puja. So it's interesting though, because you've got the high caste Nambutris being protecting their purity, offering substitute blood to low caste to a deity who in the low caste would be offered real blood. So it's an interesting contrast.
I'm just thinking about the British forbidding that. Is it curious, isn't it? I mean, the British are very class-ridden. Maybe something to do with that? No social mobility.
That's right, it could be that.
In your...
Keeping your place, yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure. Shocking. Shocking, isn't it?
It's shocking. Yeah, but two more facts about this. So you've got three.
Well, anyway, they didn't like it. They objected to the idea that they were being treated as impure, and that the husband wasn't there, i.e., the father with the children. Maybe, I mean, there could be two ways of looking at it.
It could be
puritanical.
Sorry, it could be two ways of looking at it.
Yes.
It may be from the I'm not saying that it was right.
This is for protection of women. That
it might have been to do with the protection that they thought that they were being unduly taken advantage of.
It could be.
I mean, there are two ways of looking at it, I think.
Socialism is money to a lower caste woman. It's like.
Sorry?
It's supporting lower caste women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know what.
But Zubos, he's quite good on all of that. But it's interesting that there's an echo of that social structure still today in it's certainly in that family. So there's some examples of popular Hinduism. So we've looked at some of the philosophy and the esoteric side of things, and that's a popular, contemporary popular worship. Now I think somebody told me that kind of thing is rare these days.